Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about our program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal for their wonderful support. Now on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 103, where Catherine, Sam, Greta, and Tom are discussing the article by Stephen Barley and Gideon Kunda titled Bringing Work Back In, published in the journal Organization Science in 2001. In part two, we will examine the contemporary context and whether Barley and Kunda's concerns are still present and relevant in the post-pandemic 2020s. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation. As I thought through the article and thinking through some of the big shifts in not the study of work, but just work life and organizational life in general, one of the things that just comes to mind that's of significant interest right now is the balance of work and life. Impacts of workplace climate on one's life. I mean, let's go back to Gideon Kunda's, the episode we did on him, which was all about how work life intruded or took over the personal lives of the people working in that particular tech firm. Nowadays, we're coming out of the pandemic where a lot of people have, you know, we're seeing the return back to, for some organizations, a return to the way things were, but in many other organizations, remote life and the flexibility that potentially comes with it is a big thing. It kind of strikes me that we're talking about studying work nowadays, the conceptions of work-life balance, the ways in which we address individuals' own personal needs, family needs, and those sorts of things, and accommodation is a big part of what should be in the conversation now. This is kind of not in the scope necessarily of the article, but maybe it is. But in any case, that seems to be an important topic that we should be considering. And I guess where does this fit in terms of Barley and Kunda are critiquing? Is there room for bringing that into the conversation about how we should study work-life balance a little bit more?
It's an interesting concept, isn't it, work-life balance? And I'm sure, you know, that you guys probably have a much better handle on what the definition of that is academically. But I thought it was interesting just to read a little bit about the history, kind of pre-industrial revolution, that there wasn't that segmentation between work and life, that it was just what you did. If you had a craft, it was just what you did. And there wasn't that segmentation. So I think a lot of our stress is from the segmentation of work and life, and how you have work life and then you have home life. And in more recent times, like in Gideon Kunda's book, you see a real example of where the lines are completely blurred and how that's used as a form of control, arguably, as well. And also what is defined as work. It's one of my favorite texts of all time, Engineering Culture. And there's one particular point in it, which is quite dated, where the engineer gets this fax in the middle of the night and his wife asks him what's happening. And, you know, for me, that really illuminated to me that there is a world out there that recognizes that work isn't just what you do sat at your desk from 9 till 5 or whatever your prescribed hours are. And, you know, that boundary has really blurred. And even though fax is really dated, you know, now it's emails, texts. There's so many platforms constantly fighting against each other and from you that those boundaries aren't there at all. And you have to be very arguably disciplined, you know, established in your career and in a sector that allows you to have those boundaries. And there isn't necessarily a guide to the etiquette between that. And I see that in project-based work myself. You know, I have some clients where they like to use lots of different platforms all the time, and communication, it needs to be instantaneous, and others that aren't like that at all. So it's not even as straightforward as the etiquette being very clear for everybody. It's context dependent, it's sectorally dependent, it's culturally dependent. It depends maybe where you live and, you know, what level of the job you do is at. So I'm not sure that's the answer necessarily, but it's just kind of reflection on the topic, really.
Yeah, but what this does kind of raise, though, is another way, perhaps beyond what Barley and Kundu were after, of some of the petrified images. Everything that heretofore had been about talking work-life balance, because you correctly point out there was a time when there was no differentiation. We've segmented it since on the basis of a number of studies about how the Industrial Revolution changed things. Chandler comes to mind. But all of the language about studying work-life balance begins with a, you know, with the name of it, work-life, that just that views them as separate, distinct entities. And it varies greatly according to which type of a career you're in, of course, because there are some in which you do have a physical aspect of being somewhere that you have to do. I mean, blueberry farmers are still paid by the number of pints that they pick. You know, that sort of thing. And then you have all of these other areas of work that are growing in number, that are becoming much more pervasive, where geography doesn't matter so much. But are we shackling ourselves on the basis of the old language of the separation of work and life, which may need to be set aside and critically thought about in future studies, because it just may not make sense. It may be steering us away from better ways of thinking about how, you know, what a career means, etc.
I think Christine Beckman's and Melissa Masmanian's book, if you're not familiar with it, The Dreams of the Overworked, is an excellent example of this, maybe, because what they do is they follow workers, but across both the organization and the home and all these intimate spaces, right? And so that's how they're trying to understand how in the digital area, workers are now combining all these different demands. And I really like this book because I think it is a really fresh, grounded take on this idea of the boundaries as if they're really separate or they can be separate, and they actually show how they're very much intertwined. So I think this could be a good example of, you know, taking Barley and Kundu's approach and just studying this issue of work-life balance.
The lines between the two are increasingly blurred, and work is situated in different settings. How do you conduct research that is participant observation? Again, another question rather than an answer. But, you know, how do you get around that? Because that's what they say is ultimately missing. That is, their clarion call is certainly for more participant observation over long periods of time.
Yeah. Well, Melissa and Christine do a very interesting thing here because they use, there's a podcast about this on the Ethnography Atelier on how they actually do participant observation in the home and how they combine both of those approaches. So yeah, I think it's possible. It's definitely more challenging, and you can listen to that podcast to understand all the different challenges. But yeah.
I had two things in response to the conversation you triggered, Tom. First is that we kind of equalize work with a job and how our notion of a job changed. And Barley and Kundu write some interesting stuff on the page 82, saying that, you know, prior to the Industrial Revolution, jobs simply referred to a discrete task of short duration with a distinct beginning and end. But by the mid-20th century, a job had come to signify an ongoing stream of activities attached to a role in a division of labor that was held for an indefinite period of time. So jobs had clear beginnings but no foreseeable end. The first thought that came to my mind is how thinking about, like, pre-industrial age, the industrial age, and post-industrial age, like, there is no unified linear progression. Like, you know, realities are always locally situated. And if you would go to, like, rural areas in Nepal or India or other developing economies, there might very well still be pre-industrial forms of organizing there that function well, and where the whole idea of a work-life balance is just an illusion. Like, you do work, but you also have a life. you know, sometimes you're at home and you have to take care of your child. Like, even in the post-industrial age, there are moments that are that resemble pre-industrial. So this whole idea of this linear progression and thinking about work as a job role is only one way of looking at work. And there are many other types of work that we do that deserve our attention. Like, for instance, you know, one thing that we already referred to is the non-paid work that happens in the home. And, you know, there are lots of sociologists that actually look at work non-work distinctions, like who does it, under what circumstances, like how do people perceive non-work, how do they negotiate non-work with their partners in terms of, you know, perhaps the division there. In the gig economy, this is an important topic of attention, and in contingent work in general, because there is increasingly more non-work that you have to do before you get paid work. And this is what they call work for labor. So paid work, they see as a role you get contracted, it's labor, it's remunerated. But to get it, you have to apply for jobs, write, you know, application packages. Like, you know, the packages I had to write to apply for academic jobs. Like, you know, that's a day of work for each role. And then, you know, I had 11 and a half hour days of meetings and interviews that I had to do when I got invited. Like, that's all unpaid work that is extremely exhausting. But you have to do it. It's work. You put your effort into it. It's a distinct beginning and, you know, hopefully there's an end to it. That's also work. So how we define the boundaries conceptually of what work is also changing. And another direction where conceptually those boundaries are changing is to think about like emotional labor or emotional work or social symbolic work. This is a whole trend that Nelson Phillips and Tom Lawrence, they wrote a book about it, bringing together different elements of research to look at what are elements of work that we see like it's a distinct form of activity. It might not be your job, but clearly it has a beginning and it might be a pattern of activity of indefinite period. But thinking about like emotional work, that
hostile.
Yeah.
And we have an episode on that.
Yeah. As well. The recent Academy of Management Annals publication co-authored by Rohini Jalan on body work, like the role of the body in doing work in different contexts. Like there are all these forms, like boundary work is another one, like how you draw distinctions. Like I'm sure we can come up with a whole range of other things, like things we do either in a job or outside of a job that is part of getting work done. Like, what do we think of these evolutions? Clearly, like, when you look at work as distinct from a job, you get a whole bigger perspective. But then, how do we think about what the concept of work means?
Yeah, and then there's unpaid emotional labor.
Yeah.
This is actually...
And we still call it labor, even though it's not a paid job.
Right, because there's a... We probably are thinking first and foremost about the worker doing emotional labor. There's also the spouse. And this is an area that's getting a lot of attention in my community because, for example, a military commander, there had been roles and responsibilities or protocols, perhaps, associated with the spouse of the commander. It's not unlike, although certainly not to the same degree, of like the first lady of a president. I guess that's a good enough example there. But there's a lot of those in settings where you do have a lot of responsibilities that kind of go beyond work that sort of fall onto the leader, whose spouse plays a significant symbolic role as in support of the spouse, which just kind of gets into a lot of old ideas about the gender differences in the workplace. But there's still a lot of that and how, for example, the expectations that get heaped on such individuals because the organization is either ill-equipped or not willing to pay for those types of services, yet they depend on it. They depend on it for the climate of the organization. That these people are pressed into service in an unpaid fashion and expected to be part of the package. I don't know how else to put it, and I don't know. Right now, it's becoming a very hot research topic in my area, because it runs right up against a lot of the things we were discussing? Do we have the conceptual frameworks down to look at that? I'm not in that particular field, but...
I really like your bringing up that example. And it makes me think of my childhood where, you know, my dad was the local doctor, the local family doctor, and there was no mobile phone. So when he had a weekend shift, usually this started Friday 5 p.m. and it ended Monday morning 8 a.m. And when he had to go visit a patient, all the responsibility on picking up the phone fell on my mom. So as the doctor's wife, you not only had to be there, you couldn't leave the house to bring your kids to like a friend or do grocery shopping. So it was not only taking your time, you also had to develop lots of expertise answering the phone and saying something because, you know, you never knew when the doctor would come back and go to see that patient. So it's a pretty similar setting. Like the rise of the mobile phone gave a lot of liberty to the spouses of doctors in that they then actually had a weekend when their partner was working.
I think a similar setting to that is in religious organizations. My friend is a vicar. She's a priest and her husband is picking up the slack with, because still some people ring the vicarage to speak to her or don't have mobile phones. But there's a certain expectation that he will attend services with her, that, you know, he will come to every event with her. He will talk with people. He will keep them company while she's with somebody else, while they wait for her. Unpaid labor, but there's an expectation from the employer, and as well because it is seen as a vocation that, you know, you should accept that as just part of what you do, and it is unpaid. And the other thing that came to mind as well was the recognition in more recent years, I guess, from in an equality perspective, in kind of heterosexual marriages where the man was the breadwinner, and in divorces with women, that those finally has been some recognition of women's work in the home and looking after children where they haven't. You have to be careful even what you say about it, because it sounds like women who didn't work, and our language around that has really changed, because of course they were working. They were working in the home and supporting. Inevitably, it ended up being a man going out to work. So yeah, there is a, you know, maybe the term work, we need to change that to labor, because maybe that encompasses more, but maybe that's loaded as well.
Yeah, I think I actually would support the opposite. I think, at least for me, maybe that's also, you know, English is a second language thing, but labor for me, it's about this like officially recognized, right, like jobs and labor markets and all these things. Whereas when we talk about work, for me is less loaded. And I think all of the examples, beautiful examples that you've mentioned, I don't think we would be able to understand the roles that spouses play, you know, in doing a certain type of work, if we don't follow the work, right? Which is what Kunda and Barley are saying. Like if we're just to focus on the organization or even the profession, we would not be able to understand these relationships and how even family life and all these other things are configured and shaped around covering the necessities of a certain type of work, right? I mean, going back to Greta's point on this idea of the social symbolic work, I think, I don't know, I don't have a clear response to how it relates to this paper. What I do think that we should point out is that the authors do not make any recommendations for like concepts or way, right? They're not really recommending like conceptual tools, but they focus on the methods. And I think the idea behind this, and maybe why I would prefer this approach to this, what's being proposed in the social symbolic work, is that you need to focus on what people actually do, and then you can develop all these new concepts to understand work and organizations and all that, right?
Yeah, I like that as well. And if we think about how the concept of a job evolved from a distinct activity to an ongoing stream of activities, when we think about like work that happens outside of a job, we might also see an evolution there, that there are ongoing streams of activities that we do see as work. My fieldwork involved a tremendous amount of emotional labor. It was exhausting. It was extremely exhausting. doing field work from 6 a.m. in the morning till 7 p.m. in the evening. And the weekend I was completely, I had to recharge my battery. And even after my field work, it took me a couple weeks to recover. That is an ongoing stream of things associated with doing field work, which was my work, that we should find a language to talk about, because it matters to the work at hand. And even when this work is unpaid, I guess, like, by looking more up close at the work at hand, either observing it and perhaps combining it also by listening how people talk about doing their work, we notice we need to broaden up our vocabulary, being able to talk about different facets of work, like either inside the home, outside the home, the work that you do yourself, or the demands placed on you by the work that your spouse does. And especially also looking at how all of that is changing. Like, we all saw that with the pandemic, a lot of responsibilities in the home led to very traditional role divisions where, the woman at home had to pick up the slack at home. And we even looked at, okay, like, who gets the best workspace in the house? It was often given to the man in the house, or the breadwinner, so to say. Looking at changes in work, looking at work up close, automatically leads to a broader vocabulary. But I do think that, looking at work as something that you do, and looking at work that happens inside the job should be part of that study as well.
Yeah, because as we all know, not everything that we do in our organizational life is work, right? As an example, the water cooler conversation, some of the social aspects. I know that, like, for our administrative assistants, there's these other expectations that are sort of not part of the job description that they do to help with things like, it's some very, very important morale boosting sort of activities, like what we would call a cup and flower fund. It's where you have some sort of a process by which you can collect funds in order to, when somebody gives birth to a child, somebody has a family member pass away and things like that. You have a ready pool of resources to deliver condolences, issue congratulations, and do that sort of thing. There's also more or less, I guess I'm kind of bringing in back to the section that they talk about the socio-technical systems framework, because they did talk about that as one of the leading ideas from the original conceptions about work, is the social fabric of the organization. And we're sort of taking this now and thinking more broadly about the social fabric that wraps around both one's occupational, professional life and connected with the home life much more than, say, in the past. Phrase in one part of that social fabric can impact other parts of the social fabric, just like in the Tristan Bamford study. You start tearing apart the way that we're changing the work relationships in such a way that, you're used to having small teams that socialize together in addition to working together, who really knew what each other's role was, and et cetera. Change the technology to a different method. Tears the social fabric on the occupational side and does the same thing on the social side. And so in some ways, as I was rereading that section, and I'm thinking that part of the problem is that because these old studies, these classic studies, were done using an old context, basically using the original context in which they were written, to what extent do we need to recast them? Take the current questions now and then go back and think, well, they really did have something to say about some of the things that we're talking about now. That's not entirely novel to the present day period. Does that kind of make sense?
Yeah, I was even thinking about perhaps we can do a podcast episode where we take the notion of work central and we either revisit some of the chapters of the classic ethnographies that we discussed, or we take some other ones, like there are really good references in this paper, and just use this as an analytical lens, like through the looking glass of work, what types of work are being described here? Like, what do they talk about? And what does having all these different notions of work, what does it help us to see?
Yeah, that's good. What else do we still need to cover in the article?
Good. Shall we talk a bit about methods?
Yeah, sure we can. Sam, I think this was an area you were most interested in.
It's the part that I found very exciting as well. You know, after they do this whole criticism and show us how work and organization are very intertwined and we've forgotten about that and we're trying to come up with this great abstract generalizable concepts that are pretty empty in terms of explaining and linking work to the organization. So they do two methodological implications that I think are inspired by the critique they do as well of how this shift to quantitative methods, and even when now we're seeing more qualitative studies that they tend to focus on, or they tend to use content analysis and interviews mostly and not participant observation. And so the kind of methodological recommendations that they do is to use both field techniques and comparative designs. So field techniques, obviously, is talking about field work, participant observation, ethnography. And it's this idea of creating very rich, detailed descriptions of work life and then understanding work as it is happening in situ, right? And the relationships around it as well. And I think that probably one of the things that helps understand what they're proposing here is the comparison they do of doing these field techniques as opposed to just maybe interview studies, because they make the argument that work and the patterns of work that are very important for us to understand so that we can talk about organizational issues, they are very often things that people that are doing this work find it really hard to articulate. So we can't just, you know, get close to workers and ask them, so what do you do? How do you do it? Right? Like, we actually need to immerse ourselves and observe what is happening. And they do also a kind of warning, I guess, because they recognize this notion that it's important to become really immersed in the field and become very familiar with how things are done. But they also say that it's important for us, particularly as organizational scholars and not just anthropologists, for example, to then take kind of like a step back and understand what are all those patterns that we're observing that maybe people in the field might not even be aware of or be able to articulate in the way that we can, right? So it's important for us to do both of those things.
Yeah, completely. What I also noticed in my own fieldwork is if you observe, for instance, you know, the meetings of a team that is working on a specific project, you see, like, you follow all their discussions, you also get much better interviews because they know that you know exactly what is going on. So they dare to be much more detailed and referring back to specific instances because you know the context, you're embedded. And I guess that's the critical thing, like, you know, doing interviews as part of your methodology is okay to study work, but you have to make sure you're embedded, because otherwise it gets really hard for interviewees to talk about work if you don't know the context.
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, going back to our, because I think in part one, we talked about all the difficulties associated with doing like these long ethnographic studies and how they require a lot of both time and access and funding and all the things that maybe we don't have or we don't find in every program. But I think it's, you know, by talking just about field techniques, I think there is a way to make a point here that maybe if you're not able to do a full, rich, long ethnographic study, at the very least, you can do some sort of observation so that you can have those insights and then complement with other data collection techniques.
I was going to offer that phenomenology, there are some phenomenological methods that are fairly efficient nowadays. I used one for my dissertation, which was on identity transition. The nice thing is that at least with using that type of a method, you could do a quick preliminary study of some kind to find out if there's a there before you go investing in a more intense qualitative approach. Because I think that's one of the things that might be a bit of a barrier to entry for some researchers, is this idea that, you know, if you're going to commit to an ethnography, it's a big thing. But there are ways of, you know, sort of doing stepping stones to that and at least finding out if there's something, if you think there really is something to be further studied that would benefit from an ethnographic approach.
Yeah, definitely. And I think one distinction that Barley and Kunda also make is between, you know, single site fieldwork and doing more comparative multi-site fieldwork. you know, this is just my very subjective own experience, but I have the feeling that European scholars often do more single-site ethnographies, where a lot of the US scholars are getting trained in doing comparative multi-site ethnographies. What helps you in sharpening your analytical focus is also to study the same thing in different settings. I really like this tripartite distinction that Barley and Kuhn introduced to think about like different sorts of comparative designs. Perhaps we can walk through them and think of studies that fit those descriptions. Would that be a nice one?
Yeah, go for it.
So the first one, they call the within family design, focusing on comparing and contrasting two or more lines of work that bear a strong family resemblance. And I think it was the Zuboff book that we did a podcast about that was like given as an example of that one.
Yeah. And I think if I remember correctly, I might need to check this, but I think Barley and Beth Betschke have a really cool paper as well on technicians, and they use insights from different ethnographies, right? To talk about what are technicians, what do they know, what do they do? So I think that's also a really powerful study that shows us the benefits of doing within family design.
Definitely. And then they say the second comparative approach, the key parameter design, it seeks to compare and contrast lines of work selected for their differences and similarities along dimensions that seem fruitful for explaining variation in types of work. What is a study that comes to mind there? Like this is, I guess, like a design that would fit well with your approach, Tom. Where you first do a quick pilot study and zoom in on something and then select sites where you see differences to go further, go deeper?
Yeah, it would. I was also thinking that there was an episode that we did not too long ago that sort of did the same thing. It was a study that was done of two factories. No, it wasn't Goldner.
I know which one, but I'm also trying to find. But I know which one you're talking about.
It was
about.
One where the workers were set up in a way that they couldn't interact, and the other one where they needed to use shared tools.
Yeah, I want to say it was Lupton.
It was Lupton, yes.
It was Lupton. Yeah, that I think is a good example of that, because there, you know, you did have very similar situations with two completely different sets of workers, two different environments, and the findings were really extraordinary. I'm trying to remember the episode, but that was it.
But I do wonder, Tom, if Lupton knew in advance that this was the dimension along which these two sites were markedly different. I feel like he inductively discovered it as he got access and found like really distinct patterns across these sites. And then he explained it by looking at, okay, in this one context, they didn't all have their own tools. They had to share it. And that triggered that people had to interact. And that also triggered like how they engaged in worker voice, because that was the point, right, of the Lupton episode. Whereas in the other context, where the workers were set up in the building in such a way that they minimized interaction to increase productivity, where, you know, they didn't really use worker voice.
Right. And I do remember that he did admit up front that, you know, this was something that he encountered or that emerged in his observation. He did not have, or that wasn't his research question going in.
Yeah. Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I think that's another thing about ethnographic studies that we've seen quite a number of them where the research question going in turned out not to be the research question studied in the end.
I would say that's the defining characteristic of ethnographic research.
And that's what makes it
speaks to you. Yeah. Go ahead, Sam.
No, I was going to say like that's what makes it a good study, right? Like if you follow the work, you'll eventually find very interesting stuff. Yeah.
And where current theory is limited, that's where you can make a theoretical contribution.
Want to give us the third one?
Yeah. Shall we go to the third? So that's that comparative approach entails an across-family design, the comparison of broadly dissimilar lines of work drawn from different occupational families. One study that came to my mind is it was published in Organization Science. It's a study by Lindsay Cameron and Hatim Rama, where they look at resistance and control in the gig economy, where you think, like, isn't that the same setting? But they study freelancers that do online labor on these online labor platforms and Uber drivers. So these are distinct occupations historically, you know, taxi drivers versus, you know, freelancers like, you know, software engineers in two very different contexts. But they are looking at, okay, like what happens when work becomes like mediated by these platforms with how they can express their resistance towards certain things. I found it a very nice example of this comparative design.
Yeah, I guess this doesn't count as quite the same type of research, but Chandler struck me as a similar thing. I mean, it's a historical look at different industries, all tied towards looking at the emergence of middle management as it came in through different occupations. But that wasn't really research in the way that we're talking here. That was more of a historical study over a long period, you know, covering a couple of centuries of how different industries emerged, how they competed, and how they reorganized over time, eventually to form the modern corporation. Although it's obviously a different type of study than what Barley and Kunder are talking about, that's another way where you can bring in a cross-family reviews, looking at different historical trends and seeing what commonalities emerge.
Yeah, I was thinking about Abbott right just now. Yeah, I think he does the same, right? Like he looks at similarities and differences across different types of professions. So I think that's a really good example. I didn't get this very, not so clear about what they're recommending, but the way I understand it is you can pick different lines of work either within the same context or across different contexts, right? Like this is where the importance of research design and of training people to be able to understand and be creative with research design comes in, right? Like you might want to keep some dimensions controlled and then vary among other dimensions, etc. So, yeah.
Yes, I agree. I do see like this was a challenge I encountered in my own fieldwork. If you want to study how work gets done, but more and more work is becoming invisible for observation, how can you still study it using fieldwork techniques? And what are the risks of becoming methodologically too rigorous as reviewers? For instance, one thing I see is that a lot of the studies on the adoption of new technologies is being done in hospital contexts. And these are often, you know, technologies with high barriers to adoption, with big implications. But if you study like operating rooms or medical contexts, like the work is happening there. So you have a good setting to see how the technology is being used. But for instance, if you look at, you know, how professions are adopting ChatGPT, like, you know, first of all, a lot of professions work from home where you don't have access to observe them. So perhaps you might be able to enter an organization and, you know, join all their weekly or daily stand-ups where they share like how they use ChatGPT, but you cannot access like parts of the work where these technologies are being used. Yeah, this is like a methodological challenge that we see, that new technologies are also transforming the nature of the work, where sometimes it creates settings where it's not as visibly observable as we would like it to be. And we also have to accept as researchers that that is happening. And so we have to sometimes loosen our criteria of what counts as, you know, observation, and perhaps also thinking of other methods that can complement or might make visible the stuff that we can't see directly.
Yes, there's an increasing use of this idea of diaries as well, which was particularly used with the pandemic because you could no longer, you know, ethnographers that were about to begin their incredible field work suddenly had to come up with ideas of how to collect data with people being in their own homes and not being able to interact and be in contact. So, yeah, I think that's one of the few good things about the pandemic is that it made us maybe a little bit more innovative in our field methods.
Yeah, but the question becomes, do we lose that going back? I mean, diaries, journals was such an important part of professional life back in the day, whatever I mean by that. Like, for example, when we do in military, when we do a lot of leadership studies, especially of historical events, we're able to rely on very rich journaling senior leaders were doing at the time. I mean, and there are most of them are available in the public domain. They're very richly available. And the thing was, because it was an art form of its own, when you did those, you did a pretty good job of capturing your emotions. You're capturing your thought processes, because it was about the only way you could really capture them. And it's something that does some of us in that field are interested in trying to push, because, you know, when we're talking about work-life balance, one thing that gets squeezed out is any white space for doing things like reflective thinking, reflective writing. The pandemic offered perhaps a glimpse of what the value is, not just for the purposes of research, but also for the purposes of one's own self-development. It's a great tool, but you've got to be able to have the time to do it and the skills to do it. And that's something that, you know, it's getting squeezed out, especially as all these work patterns are changing. But it's something that I would certainly encourage anybody to try to do.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I'm thinking, you know, engineers often have retrospectives where they do take time to reflect on, you know, their SWOT analysis, the strengths and weaknesses, opportunities and threats. What can they improve as a team? I'm not sure, Catherine, do you use like any of those things in more project-based work?
Not enough, really, because the pace of work is so fast. You're almost on to the next project before you finish the last one. But we're trying to introduce more time for reflections, analysis of kind of what happened, what went well, what can be taken on to the next project. But it's just kind of got me thinking there about, I'm jumping a bit, but how we were talking about how what the challenges are to participant observation, I guess, in work as it is at the moment. But technology maybe offers opportunities for more observation as well, depending on how they're utilized, right? So there might be, and maybe you have some examples of it, Greta, I don't know, where you've used technology to observe or to be more embedded in a way that perhaps wouldn't have been open to you without the technology.
Oh yeah, definitely. In these tech companies, often with a click on a button, you're in a meeting. And that made it very easy for me to study multiple projects simultaneously. Like, I also had to make choices, like when meetings were happening at the same time, like which one do I attend? The critical ones, I sometimes asked the team members to make a recording for me and then share it afterwards if I couldn't attend in person. Like, also the nature of a meeting changes. That's a podcast I did with the Ethnography Atelier. Like, often a lot of work that requires co-working and collaborating simultaneously at the same time is happening in meetings. So meetings is not just talking about work, but often also executing on it. But definitely, you know, getting access and also including remote people in decision making, like, technology has been revolutionary there. And I think we all experienced that in the pandemic. And we're now trying to find like these new balances of what meetings do we make hybrid? Do we allow remote students to attend classes remotely or not? Or do we require them to be physically present? We're still, I think a lot of companies are still figuring out what the right balance is, but it does lead to conversations about which voices are left out if you make on-site a requirement. Yeah.
Typical backlash. I mean, it's.
That's a whole other discussion, isn't it, around hybrid working and when you have to be, your work demands that you are on-site physically, and even within companies, some people can have hybrid work. In my work, some clients demand on-site only. Some are very happy to do everything from home, and some are somewhere in between. So there's no consistency even across a range of clients, and you have to be adaptable to what the client needs are as well.
Yeah, and I think this discussion has implications for like the formal spaces of work, but also the informal ones. I found in the couple of ethnographies that I've done, one in a kind of community organizing campaign and another one in a government organization, so hugely different settings. And in one was, you know, before the pandemic, one was during the pandemic. And I found, for example, getting added and invited into Telegram groups or WhatsApp groups and and drives and things where they just interact informally. And then you also see a mix of discussions and work or what's going to happen next week or whatever. And that's also what you want to observe, right? Even if you're doing field work on site, even if it doesn't involve working from home or whatever, but so much of the interaction now goes through those channels as well.
The company that I did a case study on for my dissertation, for my MBA, was a tech company. And they had an app where they observed and rated each other continuously all day long, 7 days a week. But interestingly, I did do some participant observation, but only for 2 days. Very quickly, I realized there was a WhatsApp group that certain people were allowed in and certain people weren't. And there was this kind of under-narrative flowing across everything that was happening officially on the app and everything that was happening on WhatsApp. And then there were subgroups of WhatsApp, and, you know, depended on what groups you were in, inevitably. You know, it was very intense work and very emotional work, I think. And also a lot of young people, you know, straight out of university with their, I could talk about it forever, with their lives on show, their personal lives on show.
No, I find it super interesting, you know, how the embrace of these new technologies by management to check, verify and control your workers actually leads workers to make their work invisible and do it somewhere else where they don't have access. Like, you know, I find it super scary that, you know, for instance, with Slack, when you have a company account, the account holder can access any chat that is happening there, and they can do like sentiment analysis to find like which chats people express their discontent, and then look like what people are saying, and that can be used against you and promotion and firing decisions. I find it super scary. And what you describe is, you know, really like the unintended consequences of that. And, you know, that's a very current issue that could be a topic of a PhD student nowadays, I would say. Yeah.
Probably is. Do we have any last thoughts or reflections before we wrap?
Yeah, I think we've been a pretty non-critical group because we just subscribe to this idea of, yes, let's study work and let's focus on the
we
work.
We needed somebody in who completely disagreed.
Yeah. Yes, we do.
Who but hate also- Steve Barley.
Yeah, I think that's pretty hard to find. But go ahead, Brett.
Yeah.
I guess I can give an example of a former colleague of mine who is a social data scientist. So he only uses, you know, computational methods and big data. And one project he was working on at the time was, I believe, with the British Museum. It might be another museum, don't hold me accountable for it. But they got, like, all the visitors of the museum have, like, this audio tour, and that was tracing their movements in the museum. And so they gave all this data about how the visitors moved in the museum to my colleague to look at what is the behavior of visitors and are there any improvements we can make in how we exhibit like the artworks or whatever it was. So it better aligns with how people behave in a museum, because we don't know anything about how people behave and we have all this data. So then he used his computational methods to really map out everything. He analyzed it, and there were like few spots in the map of the museum where people didn't come. And he couldn't explain, like, why was it that people didn't go there? And then when he was visiting the museum, he actually went to those spots and he realized there were actually some plants there. And people walked around the plants. And I guess, you know, using this as a metaphor for why we need to study work, like, sometimes by looking at how things actually happen in reality, it's immediately you understand why things are happening as they go. That is, that we are unable to grasp with any other methodology. And I guess that's why, you know, we need to study work and why this paper is still relevant.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.